to resume now, we have a situation where the Chinese have invaded in some force.
As they had warned.
As they had warned they would do, yes. A warning which I believe came through several sources, is that correct?
Came to Chuan Lai, to Patikar, as I recall. I think that the Joint Chiefs must have credited to some extent, because one of were their instructions to MacArthur, would you suspend that for a moment? On September 27th, the Joint Chiefs of Staff sent an instruction to MacArthur. Your military objective is the destruction of the North Korean armed forces. In attaining this objective, you are authorized to conduct military operations, including amphibious and airborne landings or ground operations north of the 38th parallel in Korea, provided that at the time of such operations, there has been no entry into North Korea by major Soviet or Chinese communist forces, no announcement of intended entry, nor a threat to counter our operations militarily in North Korea. Under no circumstances, however, will your forces cross the Manchurian or USS borders of Korea, USSR borders of Korea, and, as a matter of policy, no non-Korean ground forces will be used in the northeast provinces bordering the Soviet Union or in the area along the Manchurian border. Furthermore, support of your operations north or south of the 38th parallel will not include air or naval action against Manchuria or against USSR territory. That's quoted from the Joint Chiefs. Now, you see, that's related to your question, because there was an announcement, if you announced of intended entry, unless the Joint Chiefs was quibbling, and by announcement, a formal pronunciamento. And there certainly was a threat to counter our operations militarily, you see. And so this is why I always felt that the Joint Chiefs of Staff failed to follow up their own instructions. And this is what I think that what happened was that I have believed that, that MacArthur's action was acquiesced in by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's what they decided for whatever reason that okay, if he thinks it's necessary, let him do it. That was really what the situation was.
Now, when the Chinese did in fact invade, what was the reaction in New York among the delegations? Was there a panic that the battle had been lost now, or was there an acceptance?
Well, let me just answer that in two ways. Because Jeb was, Jeb and I were very close at that time. He says this. May I read? This is being about that he refers to me here. So, but I don't mean to read. Thus, in New York, there was formed the best possible basis for Anglo-American cooperation. Absolute personal confidence between the men on the job. Meaning him, me primarily, as he says, as soon we were to need it. I shall never forget the night when Ernie, that's me, came round to see me at Essex House with the terrible news of the rout of the 8th Army by the Chinese and the impending threat to the 10th Army on the northwestern flank. It was obvious that there could be a danger that British public opinion might attack MacArthur and the American policy of the non-recognition of China, and that the Americans might tell the British that it was all partly their fault for not having sent enough troops, and so forth. He goes on from there. Now that was not an untypical reaction. It was a reaction I had the same feeling at that time when I told the reported to the delegations on the Security Council what had happened. that their reaction was similar in certain respects to the reaction when I told them of the invasion of the North Korean forces. Mm-hmm. I couldn't help feeling that. So I think that I wouldn't say panic. I would say that there was alarm in both instances. Alarm would be a better word than panic, because I mean nobody threw themselves out of windows and things like that. What occurs to me is that in Washington, there was something that might be called a little more than alarm,
yeah,
because the forces were being chewed up. And on, I think it was the day after the rout of the Eighth Army, when we went to Austin and all, I would come into to Washington, I met in Acheson's office with Brusk, Hickerson, I think, and a couple of generals, I forget who they were, but top people, joint chiefs of staff, I don't remember their individuals, were at that time, with maps. It's a kind of a situation room, but it was in the secretary's conference room, not in his office, and next door to his office. And they outlined for Austin and me what was happening there. And I remember one of the generals said, this is the first time in recorded military history that we were aware that two large forces on the offensive ran into each other. And the result was total disaster for the U.S. forces. They were really being chewed up. So the reason for summoning us to tell us that was that to start the thinking in terms of a ceasefire. It was urgent. And that led to, that I was instructed, Austin and I, but Austin left it pretty much to me. I was always watching and always wisely advising, but nonetheless, the acting, the action, was I was looked to, I guess, to establish whether or not New York or just where, what form, if any,
to seek a ceasefire, you mean?
Yeah, there was no response in New York, so it was obvious that Stalin wanted to handle it in Moscow, which I was relieved to. I think that Acheson had forgotten about that because he mentions the fact that we tried to negotiate in New York in his memoirs. He says that. But that it was an amateur approach or something like that. But actually, it was not an attempt to negotiate. It was to try, in my mind, to find out where they wanted to negotiate so I could report back. Acheson obviously had forgotten that.
Now, eventually, the front was stabilized in the summer.
Yes.
And at this point, I believe the Secretary General took the initiative in proposing a purely military ceasefire to be negotiated by the military commanders. Do you recall whether this was Trigby Lee's idea or whether it was something that you had discussed with him?
No, I didn't. I hadn't been involved in that.
You had not been involved in that, because in fact that's what eventually happened.
Yeah.
So this seems to have originated with the Secretary General.
Well, as far as I know, but that's just my own lack of knowledge of the subject.
And this produced, about the same time, a fairly positive response in a broadcast by Malik, to which you have referred earlier.
Right. That's right.
Did you attribute significance to the Malik broadcast
at
that point?
Oh, yes. Oh, it was a signal, clear signal.
And how was this followed up on the American side?
By continued exploration of where they wanted to explore it. And that's when, specifically, when I brought, when Mr. Corey, Tom Corey, who was the Russian-speaking member and Sovietologist on the, at the mission, I had him call the Soviet delegation to really, in effect, find out whether Malik wanted to talk to us. And got no response. And we got no response. And then at a Security Council dinner, because they had, at that time, they had monthly dinners. A picture was taken and published, and a big picture in the of Malik, Jeb, and myself, and all of us wearing white dinner jackets. It was I think it was at that time. Oh, it was wait, sometime later. Mm. Oh, sometime later. And so somebody asked me, one of the reporters, who said, it's good to see you because they're smiling at each other, something like that. And so I said, well, we've been out of touch for a long time, which, I mean, he'd got the Malik understood that I was kind of crying because he didn't call. It was obviously the Soviet government wanted to handle that problem in Moscow, and I think rightly so. And my recollection is that Kennan was sent over.
Yes, I believe Kennan had two conversations in May and in June.
In Moscow,
yeah, right.
And our Ambassador Kirk, Alan Kirk, at that time, as I remember. So that was the right forum for this, because everything had, at that point, had to be Gromyko and Stalin. Malik couldn't handle it in New York. It's impossible. It was naive to think that. But we left the door open in case they wanted to. See, we had in mind the Malik-Jessup talks. That had been in the UN setting. And we thought, that, well, if he wanted to do that, okay. But I didn't expect he would. I never did.
But it's your impression, then, that the agreement on the part of the military leaders in the North to talks, which I think was on July the 10th, that this did reflect the Soviet signal and the conversations?
Yes, I think it's very. That's a very interesting field for speculation, why it was that the Chinese were fighting and the Russians made the speech, made the proposal. Just what the relationship was. May I speculate for a moment?
By all means.
Because having been rather, you know, intimately exposed to that from the beginning of June 25th on, I began to wonder whether, and I kind of try to sound Malik out in a delicate way on this from time to time, I began to wonder whether the assuming that the Soviets had mounted the North Korea, and certainly staged the forces, there's no question about that, whether the Soviet Union was not trying to, had in mind establishing a sort of place d'armes and Korea flanking the Soviet Union on that side. I remember one day T.F. Chiang said, do you mind speculation?
No, not at all.
I remember Ambassador T.F. Chiang one day said to me, I think it was shortly before he was recalled, leaving the mission, I think he came to my office to give me a kind of advice. That was when he said we were very impatient about, as Americans, that we didn't, the course of history ran in longer periods and deeper channels, and we in our impetuosity, like, you know, he was giving me the regular Chinese lecture on Confucianism, patience and whatnot. But he said, for example, he said, you know, I've been representing the Chinese nationalist government here for some years. They've been good friends. I'm no communist, he said, as you know. But he said, I will say this, that if you take a long view of history, it might be shorter than we think, that Soviet Union and China will turn against each other when they feel they cannot, with profit, gain anything more by moving in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
I was impressed by that, set that, reported. I said, I'm going to report this to the State Department. He said, it's up to you, but I said, okay. So, but then I said, what do you think, TF, the Chinese were approved, let's say were enthusiastic about the Soviet staging of the North Korean aggression? He said, I didn't include this in my message, but he said, no, they couldn't have approved of it. So what didn't profit the China in any way? In fact, it represented a potential threat. So I said, then do you think that when the Chinese invaded Korea, that they were then fearful that it would come under the U.S. hegemony, that would be another danger would be substituted for the Chinese danger on their flag? He said, yes, he said, I think so. He said, that leads to the next question, which is, did the Chinese invasion then seek not only to drive out the UN forces, but also to extirpate the Soviet influence there and create a Chinese hegemony, now that both the American and the Russian hegemony threat was removed? He said, I think so. So we worked out our little formulation there. And I believe myself, largely through influence by T.F. Chiang, that was the story. The real background, but that's pure speculation. But nonetheless, I haven't come across anything to shake that. I don't know how you would feel about it, but that's.
It does lead to the speculation, as you say, as to why the Soviets took the lead in.
It would explain that.
And the Soviets clearly may not have wanted the Chinese to gain more than they had already gained.
That's exactly the point. It's why it's consistent with this. Because when he and I were talking, Ambassador Chiang and I were talking, it was after that radio broadcast in which the proposal was made.
After the military commanders began to meet, one of the...
At Panmunjom.
First at Kaesong, I think.
Yeah, but first at Kaesong, and then they moved.
Northern side began a campaign about alleged U.S. utilization of bacteriological weapons.
Germ warfare.
What was the effect of this in the United Nations?
Very great concern. I was away at some conference somewhere, and I got a call about that. And as a matter of fact, came back, and we had a midnight session at the UN. You may remember, I spoke for the U.S. that denied the Soviet charges. I got a lot of brouhaha about that. Members were concerned about that. They really were concerned about that. And I think one of the weaknesses of our position, which was rather, I found acutely embarrassing, was that we were one of the few nations having led in the adoption of the Geneva Convention back in, 1929, the Geneva Protocol outlawing the use of chemical and biological agents in war, that we never ratified it. And the Chinese used that. We had always had in mind the use of germ or biological, they call it germ warfare, biological agents. It was very difficult to. We proposed that the International Red Cross be called upon to go in and investigate and so forth and so on. But the Russians were doing this, obviously, for propaganda purposes. Whether I doubt myself that it was true. So there was considerable consternation, yes, considerable. And some of the members credited the Soviet attack. Why they did that at that point, I'm not sure.
Because it was carried on for a considerable time.
Yes, it was, yeah.
And then it was followed, actually, following, I suppose, the signing of the armistice agreement by the very serious problems with regard to prisoners of war.
Oh, that was very serious.
And I wonder if you could describe that, how you experienced it in New York.
Oh, yes, yes, that was very serious. That led to a very embarrassing public split between the United States and the United Kingdom. That was, well, in a sense, to encapsulate it, because a long story, but to encapsulate it, Chinese negotiators, really, they were Chinese negotiators for all practical purposes, insisted that the North Korean prisoners of war in the south of in the Republic of Korea be repatriated simply because they were North Koreans, and that the state interest overrode the individual interest, and, you know, philosophically, etc., etc. So the issue became one of principle. And we, of course, refused to enforceable repatriation of prisoners of war. And then when we started interrogating prisoners of war, naturally, inevitably, the Chinese accused us of brainwashing and so forth and so on, coercing them to say that they wanted to stay. And it was that very, very nasty problem. Turned out to be a very thorny political problem. Because the Indian government, their representatives started to propose all sorts of amendments and modifications and whatnot, and one of them in particular, which eroded the principle, or delayed its application, proposed amendments to the resolution was that prisoners who declared that they did not want to be repatriated should not be turned loose in the population, but should be kept in camps. And that detracted the British. And that we didn't accept. It was obvious.
The British were inclined to accept that.
Oh, yes, they were inclined to accept it. And I remember at the time, there was a lot of, came out. This was the Herald Tribune headline.
Remember that?
Uh-huh. U.S. Britain, big front page. U.S. Britain split in U.N. on amending India plan for Korea war prisoners. 21 allies are called into session today. This is November 23rd, 52. Subcap heading. Gross, Eaton failed to agree as U.S. insists on Boris to forced repatriation. The reason I was involved with Eaton, and who was in New York, and his Minister of State, Selvin Lloyd, was that Acheson, secretary, was in Canada on a conference with the Canadian government about something, rather. So he instructed me to meet with Eden and to explain our objections. The mission leaked it. And
it's okay.
The U.S. mission leaked it, and as I was talking with Lloyd and Eaton, who was a messenger came in, with a piece of paper, showed it to Selwyn Lloyd. Selwyn read it. Without saying anything to me, he passed it to Eaton. Eaton said nothing, but except that the atmosphere chilled. And I learned that before I left that there had been a wire service report that the mission, while the meeting was going on, put out an account, a wire service account, that we were split and having trouble with the British. And that came into Eden while we were talking at the Waldorf, I think it was. And the mission thought, apparently, totally uninstructed, the mission of public relations information people thought that this pressure would help. I mean, obviously, I mean, it was stupid. But the story broke. Acheson rather unkindly says in his memoirs that although I was energetic and able, who he left it to me, that he learned never to do it, never send a boy to do a man's job is what he meant. But so he had forgotten if he ever knew what the hell had happened at that meeting. That really was terrible development.
That brings me to another question. Acheson was spending a good bit of time in New York, I believe, in this period.
He was there for the General Assembly.
Right. Yeah. And I wondered, what was the reaction to Acheson in among the delegations? How was he very effective as the U.S. Secretary of State at this critical point in his relations with the other countries there?
I think they respected him. They respected him. I don't think that he got into many discussions with him, as I was aware of. I mean, I think he kind of felt the UN was a bit of a sideshow.
Well, that was the second question I was going to ask. What was his attitude toward the UN at this point?
Well, it always had been, I guess. When I told him I was then, before going up to the UN, I was Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations. Well, he had had that job years before. When he asked me to do it, he said, it's obviously important to me because, as you know, I did that and I hope we should take it on. I had no thought of taking it on. But anyway, so finally, after the year was over, the end of the year, of 49, we had done the NATO and a few other odds and ends, and that was very interesting.
Hold it.